Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back counting down our favorite 100 movies of all time. And today we are going into our second grouping of 10 here. We're 10 films already each. And today we hit number 90 going into our second grouping, John. That's pretty amazing. That's 11 straight weeks that we've been doing this. And tonight I am talking about my number 90 up. John is talking about Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, a movie that is actually taking the place of his real number 90, Gladiator. We saw something similar happen last week with Queen Margot instead of the Two Towers, because we'll be talking about Gladiator much later on in this series where I have it. I think I have it in the 40s or 30s or something along those lines. So much higher up. But the correlation is pretty obvious, being that Russell Crowe, not too long after Gladiator, decided to do Master and Commander. John, welcome back. How's everything going?
It's good to be back. This is actually my first time watching Master and Commander in a long time this week, so it's really nice revisiting that movie. And it had also been quite a while since I'd seen Up, so a couple of movies that really brought back a lot of memories this week and are just full of adventure and really fun to talk about.
Yeah, and so I think this is one of our more similar episodes where we have two adventure movies, really, in two different styles, obviously. One is an animated one, and the other one is a big action epic directed by Peter Weir. We're going to be starting with Master and Commander tonight to make you all wait for Up. Bring it back to Surviving Without Survivor specialist Phil and Alexa talking about Disney movies. We'll make you wait a little bit for Up, but with Master and Commander, this was also the first time I had watched this movie in a very long time. I feel like I had said, this one gets swept under the rug because it wasn't a big box office success. It was meant to have numerous sequels and be part of a franchise. It failed on those accounts. Yes, if you look at the box office on it, it looks like it made $60 million. If a big blockbuster like this movie only profits $60 million, that means nobody walked away with any money, and a lot of producers lost a lot of money. So goes relatively unnoticed. Came out bad timing, same year as Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl. So there goes half of that audience because it's not enough of an adventure movie. And it came out at the same time as The Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, which Master and Commander was nominated for 10 Oscars and lost 8 of them to The Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, winning the two that Lord of the Rings was not nominated for. John, why did you go with Master and Commander as the one that you wanted to talk about here in place of Gladiator?
Master and Commander was a movie. I remember seeing this movie in the theaters and just kind of being in awe of it. I started reading the books afterwards because it's based off of a series of 20 different novels, all around the same characters. And I was thinking, what really kind of encapsulates the idea of Gladiator kind of fits with the theme of Up, and Master and Commander was the perfect choice for it. Mm-hmm. It has Russell Crowe coming off of Gladiator and A Beautiful Mind. And it also has Paul Bettany there, harkening back to our Night Sale days. And it's a really fun movie. The Napoleonic era was really popular during this time in the early aughts. And I really think that this movie was just overlooked because, again, of that timing. If you wanted a seafaring adventure, you were going to Pirates of the Caribbean. If you wanted a high fantasy action type movie, it was Return of the King. And because of that, a lot of people have forgotten about this movie, despite the fact it's an incredibly technical movie. They filmed almost all the ship scenes are all filmed in water.
So which is unbelievable. It's James Cameron's dream.
Yeah, exactly. It's fun. It's the sound design in this movie is absolutely incredible.
What makes me laugh is, as you said, that your microphone started picking up more sound. I just love when little things like that happen. That's just one of my favorite things. But yeah, the two Oscars that it did win were cinematography and sound editing. So sound editing makes sense. Kind of blows my mind Lord of the Rings wasn't nominated for cinematography. I don't really understand how that works when the third one has some of the most epic looking shots maybe in film history. So not really sure how that one wasn't nominated for cinematography, but those are the two that it wins. And this one earned both of those. Mm-hmm. It kind of gets looked past, though. You have to think, too, when this movie comes out in 2003, the third Lord of the Rings, Lost in Translation, which was a very popular adult comedy at the time. That's in my top 10, so we won't be talking about that one for a very long time. Mystic River, a very popular detective-type movie. Those are the other movies nominated for Best Picture. So it's a crowded year for Oscar movies. Mm-hmm. Then it's a crowded year for action-adventure movies. And this movie really did just kind of fall to the wayside. I think one of the biggest hindrances of this movie, both box office and just in general, is that it actually isn't enough of just an action movie. It does have those drier moments, which can be good. Some of them go on a little long, and I did find to be a little tedious at times. But I think that's what ultimately hurt this movie. When you sit down and watch this, especially when you just watch Curse of the Black Pearl, which could be one of the most entertaining movies ever made in the history of time, whether it's one of your favorites or not, it's just pure entertainment from start to finish. This does not have that same feel, and it almost leaves you saying, well, why doesn't it have that same feel?
Because it wasn't going for that same feel is what I really feel.
Yeah.
Anyone who's read the books from this very long arching series knows they are filled with technical sailor jargon. They are. I am baffled that I was reading these books in 2003 because these are hard books to read. And they really went for a realism aspect when it came to this movie. They wanted you to feel what it was like to be on one of these tall ships during the Napoleonic War. And that's why I don't mind the tedious sections in this movie, because being on a ship that long is really tedious. So I really think it kind of feels the emotion that the crew's feeling, especially during the segment where they're going through the drought and it hasn't rained for a while, and we get all the superstition and everything of the sailors. Yeah, that's one of the longest stretches where it really feels this movie is dragging on. But you're going to the same place where these sailors are going because of it.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I do think that that's that ultimately is what kind of sets it to, you know, you always have to ask the question, what is the intention of the director, of the screenwriter, and all of that? And it does make sense that they do want you to kind of feel as if you're part of the ship. Again, I think that's why it ended up gets knocked at the box office, but it is a very technical movie, very well made. My only other knock on the movie, however, is the last action scene, while very good, you cannot tell who is shooting who for about 75% of it. You really have no idea who you're actually watching get blown up. And that is one little knock I have on it. I do love that this movie sticks with just Russell Crowe and his crew. I do like that we never go outside of that, that we don't get to know the villains. I think that works really well. But at the end there, I got confused where I'm going, okay, someone just blew up. I don't know who the hell it was.
And it makes it more difficult because they, because of the tactics that they use to conceal themselves in that final combat, means that you spent the entire movie watching the ship and its crew. You know what they look like, what they're wearing all the time, what the boat looks like. And then all of a sudden it's completely different. And you're like, oh, which one's which now?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think that one of the funny things about this movie as well, you said, now we know what they look like. Billy Boyd in two movies nominated for Best Picture in the same year. Just want to throw that in there because what has he done lately? But I just thought that that was funny because you, but it's true. You know what everybody looks like. And still in the movie, you can follow the young guy. You can follow the old guy who gets shot in the head pretty much right away. And then you can follow Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany. After that, it's really hard to kind of figure out what's going on with the rest of the crew. And in this scene in particular, it just gets really difficult to keep track of what's happening. So I don't know. Still works, but definitely one of the weaker parts of the movie just because it is the big climax. And I get that it's hard to figure out how you're going to shoot that, but it just feels a little confusing.
But again, I think it's really trying to capture the feeling of what it would be like being on one of these tall ships in a cannon fight, especially at that close proximity, right? And I think there is that chaos of battle there. And the fact that we've seen more the order of running a ship up to this point, and we're now contrasting it with the chaos, does overall help with the themes of the film.
Yeah, I do agree. And so, okay, so Paul Bettany in A Knight's Tale, we were singing hisses back when we were watching A Knight's Tale. Clearly, this guy had a pretty good run up through Firewall. I think Firewall was really when after that he kind of fell off, but he's the big villain in Firewall, plays a good villain, and then he kind of disappears after that. Really good in this movie, and he does a really good job of being the opposite of Russell Crowe. That is not easy to do. You got to think Russell Crowe coming off a stretch that you could argue was just about as good as Tom Hanks in the early 90s. Now, we had made a mistake on an earlier episode and said that Liam Neeson won an Oscar. He has never won an Oscar because Tom Hanks beat him for Philadelphia. Right. But this was a similar run. Back-to-back years, he's the hot commodity now in Hollywood. He beat off good movies with his wins. A Beautiful Mind never should have won Best Picture. I'll argue that till the day I die. Everything better. Every single movie that came out that year was better than A Beautiful Mind. Every single movie. But he was as hot as could possibly be. And so for Paul Bettany, who wasn't getting this type of recognition, this type of acknowledgement, and wasn't just a minor character, Boyd, who was in this massive, you know, epic and is ultimately the most pointless character in the entire series. He really does a good job of holding his own against Russell Crowe and making it believable that this is a pairing that would have a friendship that is complicated on this type of ship.
Yeah, exactly. And these are the two primary protagonists of the novels as well. So the really interesting thing about this movie, I said I would mention the nomenclature of this movie. The first book in the series is called Master and Commander. None of this plot is from that book.
Interesting. Okay.
The majority of this plot comes from Far Side of the World, but it also pulls from a bunch of the other books in the series as well. But it, because Master and Commander is literally just about Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany's characters and their relationship and how it grows.
Yeah, and now, yeah, so we get their relationship, and then we're getting this chase pretty much for the entire movie. The entire movie is a cat and mouse game, and it really does come down to being more of like a character study than anything. And I think that's an interesting way to take a movie like this, because seafaring movies aren't something that are made often. You know, this is, you know, I just watched the original Mutiny on the Bounty. Great movie, still holds up. I think it's an absolutely phenomenal movie. Really holds up. After that, when was the next one? You get a movie like Amistad. Yeah, it takes place some on the water, but it's not really a sea movie. You know, a lot of times sea movies are more like Jaws, where it's a you know, something bad's going to happen, or a disaster movie like The Poseidon Adventure or Titanic, or you mix them both together and you get Deep Blue Sea. You don't really see these regular seafaring movies. And so it's an interesting way that they approach this with the style and the storyline, and how it was very much, we're just going to chase this one boat catches us right at the beginning, and the rest of the movie, we're going to try to outsmart them so that we can get them. And that's really what you watch for 2 hours and 15 minutes. And it doesn't ever really get tedious, which is interesting. Like, it doesn't, that storyline doesn't get boring. Again, some of the realism I actually think might be its biggest weaknesses in this movie, but that storyline doesn't get old. I think there's something to be said for that.
Yeah, and the opening scene of this film was great, because you open up, you're on the ship in this fog bank, and all you hear for the first little while is the lap of the ocean against the hull of the ship.
Yep.
And then the bell rings, and everyone starts looking around, and they spot the ship in the fog, but they're not sure if they spot the ship in the fog, and they set up this perfect amount of suspense of, like, maybe it's there, maybe it's not, and immediately set the tone for how ominous this opponent is.
Yeah.
And because of that, you spend the entire rest of the movie just wondering, how are they ever going to overcome this? Because after the first moments with the ship, you get the scene where they have the model of the boat because the person happened to see it in Boston on dry dock. And then they just go over it. It's like, it's a clearly superior ship. How are they going to defeat it?
Yeah, and ultimately, that's what you want your action-adventure movies to be. A clear setup of they have to overcome something that they don't seem capable of overcoming. You know, and some go a different route. Some go the Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones type route of a little bit more fun, a little bit more like that. And some go the more tactical route. To me, this opening borrows a lot. And I'm Saving Private Ryan. It borrows so much from Saving Private Ryan with the silence, and you're watching the crew absolutely terrified. They don't know what they're in for, but you have that feeling of impending doom, and it's quiet, and it's quiet, and it's quiet. And then all of a sudden, boom, Now it's action time. Yeah. And I really feel like this was borrowed heavily from Saving Private Ryan. And it shows how influential Saving Private Ryan was, even at the time, only 6 years old, 5 years old, because it came out in 98. It's 5 years old at the time. And it was that influential on a movie that was coming out that close to it. Because this opening is identical. It's that massive action scene that starts off quiet and starts off with young people unprepared. And then here comes Rome, much the same way that here comes Tom Hanks. And we get introduced to all of the major players in this scene, Ed Burns and Barry Pepper. Those characters are introduced very much the same way as Billy Boyd and the young kid and Paul Bettany. It's very interesting the way that this movie borrows from a not very old movie and how it still does it very effectively. And that just speaks volumes about how brilliant Steven Spielberg was in the storming of Normandy in Saving Private Ryan. It's just, it's next level filmmaking. And, you know, every movie can get away with making a scene like that if it's in the hands of a great director, because it's something that just works.
Absolutely. It sets the tension. It also sets your expectations for everything to come, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the real beauty of this, because this scene where they're just caught with their pants down really elevates the other scenes where they start gaining advantage.
Yeah. You feel a lot stronger about them when they start to win. Mm-hmm. And you feel a lot happier for them when they start to win. Yeah. I do agree that there's something about how alert Russell Crowe is the rest of the movie, you know, because at this point he's just kind of, he's sleeping really when this starts taking place. And now it's, no, I have to be on my game because I'm dealing with somebody who might be superior to me. And if I got to bring, I got to bring everything I have if I'm going to defeat him. It's a really fun movie. What do you think about, so obviously Paul Bettany's character is based on Charles Darwin, even though the movie actually takes place before Charles Darwin went to the Galapagos Islands. What do you think about the scenes on the Galapagos Islands and how that plays out?
I think those are some of the most personal scenes, because it really shows the sacrifice each of the people make in the friendship, where Paul Bettany's character has to constantly sacrifice going to the Galapagos because they have this mission. They have a task that needs to be completed, but then it's juxtaposed to the scene where he's trying to find his flightless cormorant, and he goes over the hill and he sees the ship, and he just has to drop everything because this is the time to take the ship.
Yeah. It's the Galapagos Island scenes. I do like that. I like the feuding between Russell Crowe, Paul Bettany, how that works out. And this, remember their names. I know one is Lucky Jack, but I can't remember Sam or Samuel or something, or Steven. But the feuding between them, I think, really works, because you see how important it is to Paul Bettany and when he calls it a hobby and all of that, because it always goes to the same thing. I always say that, you know, you could end a story with two kids holding hands and that would, you know, and that could stop a war if everybody saw it, and nobody would believe it. But if everybody shot each other and killed each other, you believe it. And so it's this whole peace versus violence thing. And it's the fact that Paul Bettany understands what Russell Crowe needs to do, but Russell Crowe doesn't really understand the gravity of what Paul Bettany needs to do, because it's not as easy to see. Knowing you have to kill somebody is a lot easier of a thing to understand than the future of species and dissecting things along those lines. And I do like how it ultimately ends up playing out, where they go back and he gets his moment to shine.
Well, and it's also not even just that he reveals it, but like one of the specimens he gathers on the Galapagos really allows them to win as well, because it gives Russell Crowe's character the plan of disguising the boat as a whaling ship so they could get absolutely as close as possible to the ship. Because if they're chasing the ship or trying to go after the ship normally as dressed, they're going to get blown out of the water because they're unmatched.
Yeah, and so I do like that that it's a stick bug of all things, because a stick bug to me, like growing up in the Northeast, you see those all the time. I mean, that's not even, it's like that and a lightning bug. You just knew what they were all the time. So it's funny to me that, you know, that idea of, wow, we've never seen this before. That's just such a cool idea. And I think they do handle that really well with the, you know, the way they shoot those scenes on the, in the Galapagos. I think they do a really, really good job of that. Go ahead.
I also just love that they actually filmed in the Galapagos Islands for this scene too. because they really did. I don't think there was anywhere else they could have filmed those scenes to make it actually feel like the Galapagos Islands.
No, there's certain places in the world that have to be that. And mm-hmm. and it's really these isolated places, because you can fake certain elements. You can fake a rainforest or something like that. But when you fake something that looks like you're on the face of Mars, you can't fake that. Like, that's not mm-hmm. you know when you're at this place. I mean, I was looking up, how do you even get to the Galapagos Islands? It's not easy. It's not like you just hop on a plane. And so it's a difficult little journey even to just get to the Galapagos Islands. So yeah, I really think it's cool that they were able to film so much on location and get a lot of that. I said this when I was talking about Queen Margot. Realism is always better than CGI. It's always better than replacements. It just works better. It's more exciting. And there's something about knowing that, wow, they had to go there. That's why a movie like The Revenant, which we'll be talking about in a couple weeks, I know that's a polarizing movie, but to me, I find it fascinating because they flew to uncharted territory and were like, screw it. This is how realistic we want it to look. I'm all about pretentious filmmakers getting as pretentious and as into their work as possible, because a lot of times that's when the passion really is at its best, and that's when it comes out as the best.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk about the use of the children in this movie. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the fact that the kids are on the boat, first of all? I don't really understand how that happened back in the day, so maybe you can shed some light on that. But also, how do we feel about the one right off the bat losing his arm and then the other one just getting killed at the end of the movie? How do we feel about this? Is this to pull at the heartstrings, or is there supposed to be some sort of deeper meaning to these two things?
I think it's again, falls back onto the realism. Mm-hmm. Like, children this age were sailing on these boats in this time period. And I actually didn't even mind the child actors in this movie.
No, they were very good.
Very, very good job. And even though you know you're watching a child, like, you don't feel like it's a child, because they are acting so grown up while still having that bit of childhood innocence on this ship. Mm-hmm. Because they have to. They are active soldiers.
Yeah, and they definitely, you know, child actors are so hit or miss. I mean, you get a bad child actor, it can ruin an entire movie, an entire TV show. And they did do a very good job with the casting of these. They did a very good job casting, I think, just across the board. They did a good job of making these people all feel like the real person that you would be watching in the situation. They feel grimy. They feel like they're starving on a boat. You know, I always think about the Muppets Treasure Island, how they have the whole joke sequence of whatever. The brilliance of them of a movie like The Muppets, or a concept like The Muppets, is that everything they're taking is actually being taken from real things. I think that's what's so fascinating is, you know, when they're doing their We Have Cabin Fever song, and it's this whole ridiculous, like, you know, song and dance. And it's like, I don't know what the style is, but it's almost pulled. Master Commander almost pulls exactly from that with this still water and all of that. So I think it did do a good job with the kids, and I think it did a good job with the guy who ends up committing suicide. I forget what his name is, Hole or something like that. He's very good. They just did a good job casting this movie where, yes, you needed a big name to carry this. Otherwise, nobody was going to go see this movie. I mean, it's bad enough barely anybody did anyway, but nobody was going to go see it. So I think that really worked in its favor. But I think all of the side characters were just to a T what you would think would actually be on a boat like this during that time, and they would be as disgusting as they look in this movie.
Oh, yeah. There are scenes where you're just looking at them and you're just imagining the smell that must be coming off these people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's disgusting. All right.
One of the things that actually bugged me about the film, though, is we have this huge sequence leading up to the one character's suicide where they're talking about, like, the curse of Jonah and stuff like that. And then the very next scene, someone tries to kill an albatross.
Yes, which is supposedly the worst luck.
Yeah. And they shoot the doctor instead. So maybe don't shoot seabirds, guys.
Don't shoot seabirds. Yes, yes. And go listen to Echoes by Pink Floyd. 23 minutes and 21 seconds of pure bliss, and albatross is mentioned. So, but yes, albatrosses are, you know, they're supposed to be like the bird of the lucky, and that's what they're all excited about. And the guy's trying to shoot it down, and then he ends up shooting the doctor. It's crazy. One thing I do want to ask, and then I'll ask you one final question before we go. But what do we think about this long lingering shot, point of view from Russell Crowe on the one woman essentially who is in this movie? What do we think about this?
It kind of feels out of place with the rest of the movie. Hmm. but it's also very indicative of the era. Mm-hmm. So clearly it's not the type of movie they were trying to make. They weren't trying to make this like, it's not like Beauty on the Bounty, right? Where they go to Tahiti and everyone falls in love with the woman there and want to stay there forever. But I think they want this long, like this long shot of him looking at this woman just to show that he's above that. I think it is a character moment for Russell Crowe's character to show that he's above what other people in that era were like.
But also I feel like that it's also saying there's something that was there. There is something that we're not being told about him that he'll never bring up to any of the men there. And that one shot is really all we're getting about it, that there's some missing family or missing woman or something like that in his life that at one time he might've had. And this girl reminds him of, but I love that they don't have any hokey love story or anything like that. It would have just been stupid. The love story is between Paul Bettany and Russell Crowe.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is the heart of the series that this is based off of too, is the relationship between those two characters. Yep. And I think you might be very right about this shot, because it very well could have been a setup shot for something later on, because there were intentions to make this a very large series.
This was supposed to be exactly what Pirates of the Caribbean has turned into, where now there's five or six of them, whatever it is. That was the intention with Master and Commander. Came out the wrong year. This really comes out in 2002. Totally different vibe. 2002 is a good year for movies, but a different year for movies. We talked about it when we talked about the hours. If it comes out before Pirates of the Caribbean, it's fine. Coming out at the same time of Pirates of the Caribbean, I don't remember which came out first. I do believe that Pirates of the Caribbean did come out first.
I think so, because I believe this was later in the year, because it was more billed as an Oscar movie.
Yeah, it was. And I think they didn't want to go head-to-head with Pirates of the Caribbean, which came out in the summer, and they knew it was going to be a massive hit.
Yeah.
But even if this came out before it, people were going to in the same year, people were going to pass over it, because they were going to say, well, we'll just see Pirates when that comes out. Because this was at the time when, you know, really all you saw was a trailer, and you went to the movies. And you owned a VHS, you went to the video store. This was a perfect go-to-the-video-store-and-rent-it movie, because everybody else was going to see Pirates of the Caribbean in theaters, or at the time, Return of the King, or Lost in Translation, or Mystic River, because it's Clint Eastwood, and everybody goes and sees Clint Eastwood movies when he makes them. My final question to you before we move on, will this end up in your top 100, or is this simply a movie that's just holding the place of Gladiator?
On a rewatch, I enjoyed it a lot more than I remembered enjoying it. It's not going to break into my top 100. It's going to sit, it's probably going to sit in like that next like 100 to 150 range. Because I do really enjoy this movie. I really enjoy realism in movies. And I enjoy the feeling that it evokes. And I'm kind of bummed that it ended up being a standalone movie instead of a series. But from what I've been reading over the last couple of days about this movie, it actually kind of has a cult following. And people ask about it all the time. Russell Crowe made a comment about it like last year about whether a sequel was being made or not. So people are starting to think about this movie still.
Yeah, and that's what kind of happens with these movies that fail at the box office originally but do pick up steam. You think of something like Space Odyssey. The reason it has hit its legendary status is because of a cult following. It was a box office failure at the beginning, but the young kids liked it. And I think Master and Commander is one of those movies that, if you're not the type of person who necessarily is looking for a Pirates of the Caribbean or something along those lines, Master and Commander is the perfect movie for you. It really is, because it has all the things that you want from a type of movie like this, but it does it in the much more realistic way. And it's not Disney-fied or anything like that in any way, shape, or form. Although it's still only got a PG-13. Good for them. All right, John, let's move over to Up and talk about just a movie to me that just gets better every single time. This was a movie, the first time I watched it, I liked it. I didn't love it. Coming on the heels of WALL-E. WALL-E is my favorite Pixar movie. I do have that higher up on my list. And you know, coming on the heels of WALL-E, I felt this one was a little bit overrated. Fantastic Mr. Fox came out the same year. I was a big Wes Anderson fan. I love the style of Fantastic Mr. Fox. I think it's absolutely hilarious. I think it nails so many notes. But as I've gotten older and as I've started to watch Up more and more, it literally does get better every single time you sit down and watch it. And what I love about this movie is going into it in 2009. Now, granted, I was still in high school, so, you know, different life point. but going into it, you heard about this Carl and Ellie stuff. The first 15 minutes are going to break your heart, blah, blah, blah. Go and see it. Maybe you cry, maybe you don't. Most people probably older did at 17. I wasn't crying. Now, when I sit down and watch this movie, it's impossible to watch the first 15 minutes because the entire time that impending doom is sitting right here in my brain, and it's hard not to get emotional because you know what's going to end up happening. And I think the brilliance of Up is that no matter how many times you watch it, it still is going to pack the same emotional punch that it does on the first viewing or at whatever point in your life you're watching it. It just packs so much emotion into an hour and 36 minutes of, you know, just life. It's brilliant, I think, in the way that it does all of that. And I do think that my younger self needs to take a long look in the mirror and realize that this is just, it doesn't need to be animated. And that's the beautiful part of it. Like, it has to be because obviously a talking dog and the bird and a floating house. But if this was an animated movie and it was just about an old guy and a young kid going on an adventure, same exact plot, it just works. It's just an emotional movie with great characters. And every time I watch it, it gets better and better.
Yeah. I mean, how I felt about it this time, I was preparing myself for the first 15 minutes. It's like, it's okay, John. It's okay. You're going to cry. It's fine. Yeah. And then I got through the first 15 minutes and I didn't cry. I'm like, okay, that's fine. And then I got to the scene where the house is over them at night and like Carl's thanking Ellie for like keeping them dry and stuff. I just started bawling. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, apparently this is hitting really hard right now. Mm-hmm. And the film... Pixar is at its best when it makes an adult film for a child's audience. Mm-hmm. Because this is not a film for children. No. This is not a film where the target audience is a particular age group of kids who are going to enjoy this movie. This is a film for adults about adventure and about life and loss and getting over that loss and accepting the loss and the little adventures in life, which are not themes you're teaching children.
No.
The people our age are the people that this movie is kind of made for. And that's what Pixar does so well, is they make a film accessible to children so that it has those things that the kids love. It has a talking dog and a crazy colorful bird and a kid they can relate to in Russell, who, you know, is a child of divorce and everything like that. But because the adults can relate to everything that's happening in the movie, it brings everything together and makes it so that it kind of transcends age.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Pixar had an interesting thing happen in like the mid to late 2000s, the back half of the 2000s. So when Cars came out, that was definitely their most childish movie. That was the one that was intended to sell product and get kids to buy cars and whatever. That was intended for children. That's a movie I watched actually like just about a week ago. And it was good. There's no doubt. I mean, it's an entertaining movie for sure. But that's where it really ends. And then I feel WALL-E was actually just a straight up adult movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know what a kid is going to get out of that movie watching that at 5 or 6 or 7 years old. It's not like Toy Story or Monsters, Inc., where there's even really anything. It's a robot, and he's going on an adventure that shows how shitty humanity has become.
Yeah.
That's not really for kids. I feel like Up is when Pixar really found their groove of what do we want to be. And what's fun, Toy Story 3 comes out, it's great. And then they kind of had a bad run there of sequels and Brave. And, you know, not that these movies are bad. They're just not nearly as good as what they were making before that. Because I think they forgot that what they did in Up is what they did best. And that was they made a movie that every adult could relate to. But they gave you the fun stuff that kids like. WALL-E doesn't give you the fun stuff that kids like. Like, let's be real. A robot, sure. But other than that, there's really nothing else in there for kids. This movie did a really good job of giving you everything you could want from this kind of movie. And these adventure sequences. And I think what helps so much in this movie is that we see Carl Fredrickson as a child. Because by seeing Carl Fredrickson as a child, we now know that, okay, this is a guy who at one point was a kid. And that makes it relatable to kids. It makes it relatable to you as you're growing up, because at one point you were that age and you had that sense of adventure. And who am I going to meet that's going to totally change my life? It's really a great decision to do that and then just slap it down and say, and now he is a curmudgeon, because you do start to lose those things just as you get older. I think it does a great job of that for sure.
And part of the heartbreak of Up, of these first 15 minutes of Up, is that it's really setting up this idea that they never got to go on these adventures. They talked about them all the time, but they never got to have them. None of the event, they didn't get to go to South America. They didn't get to go to Paradise Falls. They didn't get to start the adventure of parenthood. But then it all comes back at the end of the movie, or just before the end of the movie, when Carl's flipping through the photo album and he sees that Ellie did have an adventure, and it was the adventure she wanted the entire time.
Yeah, that's one of the most brutal scenes in movie history. Everybody talks about the first few minutes. That scene,
that's when I was really crying.
That's the scene where, because it catches you off guard. In the first 15 minutes, you're like, all right, what's going to happen? You've heard about it. You're seeing it. You remember that part. Then you're like, oh, good, we're in the clear now. And then you forget. And when he sits down and he looks at that, and it says at the end, like, you know, thanks for the adventure, now go have your own, or go have another one. Like, I have chills right now and I'm getting choked up just talking about it.
Me too.
It's so brutal, because Pixar also does a good job of really saying, like, hold on to those little moments, because, you know, people get so caught up in their dreams or their goals or whatever it is, and they start to put things on the back burner that they always said they were going to do. I mean, how many people say they're going to go, you know, backpack across Europe, and then they never do it because they just never have the time. Oh, I don't have the money. I don't have the time, or any of that stuff. I find that stuff happens all the time. And so something for me that has always been important in my life, I mean, you know, I drive out to California to live in California. I'd always said when I was in high school, I wanted to drive across country, see the country, all that. I've been to 38 of the 50 states. That to me is a big deal, because that was something I always wanted to do. There's other things that I haven't done that I always thought I was going to do or wanted to do. And this movie really shows that while those things might be important, there are other things that are going to be important in your life, but don't lose that sense of wonder, because there's always time. You're never going to be too old. You're never going to run out of time. You're never going to run out of things. And, you know, it's like he couldn't have a child with Ellie, but once Ellie was gone, his replacement was this child who's not his child that he could then kind of raise and, you know, help out and do all of those things with. It's just so well done. And like I said, one of the most emotional movies I think ever made, from a excitement, fun, you laugh a lot, but also it brings you to tears on numerous occasions, because I think these characters at every level are so unbelievably relatable.
And it's all punctuated by arguably Michael Giacchino's greatest score of all time.
Of all time. I'm not going to lie to you, this might be one of my five favorite scores in film history. Mm-hmm. Once Upon a Time in the West is my favorite, but this is right there. I mean, this score is devastating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he reuses the same theme, but just his choice in instrumentation and tempo and everything to change that theme throughout it gives it so many different meanings. And they all just evoke fantastic emotions in the viewer.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, the montage music, you have got to be kidding me. That montage doesn't work the way it does without that music. And every note of that montage is perfect. Michael Giacchino is one of my favorites anyway, because of Lost and all of that. I mean, I'm a huge Lost fan, so like, I can't get enough. And you know, his whatever the theme is when everybody dies is the one of my favorite things. I listen to that all the time. I remember when this movie came out, watching the Oscars with my dad, and I had seen pretty much everything that had come out that year. That was when I really started to see every movie. The only one I hadn't seen was Precious, which I've since seen, very much enjoyed, and wish I would have seen when I was younger. Cause that is you would talk about a brutal movie. That is no fun to watch. Oh my goodness. So if you haven't seen Precious, check that one out, based on the novel Push by Sapphire, in case you didn't know. I always love that they say that every single time.
Yeah.
But anyway, I had seen everything except for Precious. I was a huge fan of Up in the Air. I didn't really like Avatar. I wasn't a big fan of The Hurt Locker, but I knew those two were the favorites to win. And really, at my heart of hearts, I was like, I don't want Avatar to win. It's popular for what I believe is no reason. And now that movie has not aged very well at all if you watch it, because you can't watch it on anything other than a big, gigantic 3D TV. Anyway, if you watch it on a normal TV, it doesn't work. But anyway, all that being said, me and my dad would always do an Oscar pool when I lived with him. And so it'd be, okay, fill it out. And I remember he's like, what do you think is going to win score? And I'm like, it's probably going to be the Hurt Locker. Like, you know, the Hurt Locker's winning everything. You know, if it's nominated, that's what's going to win. And I remember when Michael Giacchino won and my dad hadn't seen Up and that first note played, he looked at me and he goes, you really thought this was going to lose? And yeah. Like, my dad is a massive movie guy. He loves movies, but you know, he kind of dates himself and he pretty much hits 99. And then it's like, oh, this movie sucks because it's new. But he is, you know, he's always playing, like he loves the Godfather theme and the Psycho. I remember for Halloween, he owned like the horror classics, you know, music, and it would be like all the soundtracks that he would just play while like people were trick-or-treating. And he loved doing that stuff. And when he said that, he was just like, you've got to be kidding me. And I think it does evoke that emotion that very rarely happens with a score where you just tell there's something special about it. It's like J.K. Simmons in Whiplash. You watch that movie and you go, I don't care who he's against. He's just going to win. Like, he's just going to win. And you just know these things. And that score is one of those things where, oof, it'll bring you to tears when you're not watching it. You could be eating an ice cream cone on a sunny day at the beach and you're going to be crying because of some of the music in there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I am a big score guy. I mean, later on, I literally have Fantasia on my list. So I'm a big score guy. And this is easily one of the best ever made.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about Charles Muntz.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Muntz, the big villain in this movie. I like the opening here, the little montage of you know, Carl Fredrickson. This is his hero, and I think Pixar does a really good job of being, and now that's also who he's going to end up running into. What do we think about the arc of Mr. Muntz?
Well, I mean, we know what they say, right? Never meet your heroes.
Yes.
Because he became incredibly paranoid that everyone who happened to be around him was trying to steal his thunder.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was a great arc. I don't. He had to be what, 90 to 100 years old in this movie.
I mean, if Carl Fredrickson's looking like he is, and Charles Muntz was at youngest 10 years older than him.
Yeah, but I actually kind of like it. In all honesty, because it really took that emphasis. It also helps with that theme of taking the emphasis away from grandiose adventure and more focusing on the adventure of life.
Mm-hmm.
Because this great adventurer who was your childhood hero and was the epitome of everything you loved throughout your entire life turns out to be this like not great person.
Yeah.
And then it just, it once again emphasizes that moment when he's reading the photo album.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that the Charles Muntz arc is the weakest part of the movie. I still like it, but the one thing I don't like about it is how quickly he goes from liking Carl to just saying, as soon as Kevin's name is brought up, now all of a sudden he's going to kill them. Yeah. I think it's a bit of a jump in logic. Now, I do understand that he's paranoid and all of those things, but I do feel that it's just a little bit of a jump in logic because I think he would have been more negative at Carl at first if that was going to be the case. I think it's just too much of a jump a little too quickly. I still think it's good. I like the idea that he's this old. I love their fight scene where they're fighting with like the walker and their backs are going out and everything isn't working for them. I think that's really great and it's really funny and it's clever. I just think it's a little too quick for him to flip. I think there needs to be one more scene or one more thing said that says what is at stake for him. Because ultimately, with how excited Carl is to see him and all of that, you would think that it would almost be like, well, Charles, we just told you how you can get him. So we can help you bring him back and that'll clear your name.
Right.
He's not okay with that. And so I just think there needs to be one more little thing there. That's the only part. But then again, it's an action adventure movie. So the villains are kind of bad just to be bad. And out of all the villains in action adventure movies, he is one of the more interesting ones because, again, we see him younger and non-corrupted. And I think that's what makes it really cool because we know why he is so corrupted now.
Yeah, I mean, I think what it comes down to is he was so – Charles Muntz just was so offended when everyone said he lied, that he faked this discovery. And he, because of that, he just can't let anyone else be a part of it. So it, is it a jump in logic in his all of a sudden like light switch moment? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But at the same time, it's still understandable what his motivations are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. All right, so let's talk. Jake Beebe just put in here that dog just say hi there. So Doug, one of the most popular of the Pixar characters for sure, especially from the later generation. Once you get past Toy Story, I would say that he might be the most popular. The amount of mugs my fiance owns involving Doug is pretty unbelievable. How did they manage to create a dog character that is as original and as interesting as Doug is without just falling into the same dog type of nonsense that we've seen so many times, even in movies where dogs do speak?
I think a lot of the time what film studios do and like what directors do when they come to dog characters is they, if you think of like the talking dog movies, the characters are become more human. Mm-hmm. Doug's a dog.
Yeah.
Like Doug is not human at all. There are no human aspects to Doug. He is a dog through and through. And I think that's why everyone loves him so much.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's what's so fun about the dogs in general in this movie is that even though the villain dogs are the villain dogs, they're still just dogs. And you do have this idea in your head that like a Doberman would be mean to a whatever, a Labrador or something. Like mm-hmm. you just have this idea that, ooh, the dogs with the bigger bark, they're the ones who are going to, those are the ones that are going to attack or beat you or whatever it is. Yeah. And so I do think that they did a really good job of like not humanizing these dogs, but making them so believable. You think about what is your dog thinking when it's like, I'm going to run in a circle and then I'm going to sniff my butt. And then I'm just going to start barking at something that's not even there. Like what is going through your dog's mind when all of that is happening? And Bob Peterson, who wrote the screenplay, actually does the voice of Doug in this movie. And he does such a great job of just this chaotic energy. I think it's just so good. And you really do believe like this is how a dog thinks. And I love later on when all of the dogs are like squirrel and they all just stop their anger and whatever's going on, because that's what happens. One second they're barking at something and then they see a squirrel and it's like, must go.
Yeah. I think anyone who's owned a dog can tell you that the way Doug responds to everything is exactly what a dog responds to. Mm-hmm. When he first meets them, he's like, you remind me of my master and I love you. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, that's exactly what I think a dog says to me sometimes. And it just, when you can take a character and build it and not have to focus on the human elements of it, and I get to focus kind of on these other traits, it's different than what everyone else is doing, but it can also come out better. And that's what the best part of Doug's character is.
Yeah, because I think about movies like The Secret Life of Pets or Oliver and Company or something like that. They do still kind of keep these animal instincts or these animal characteristics, but they do humanize them to a point where, you know, you start thinking of them differently. Mm-hmm. Doug, you never do. I mean, Doug, nope. To me, Doug is the quintessential animated dog. I mean, he is the animated dog. And, you know, it's funny to go back and watch a movie like Toy Story where, you know, where you have the dog running around and how they're like, oh, what's he going to do? Blah, blah, blah. You could see the setup for the fact that Pixar just got dogs. Like they just knew what they were doing it when it came to, you know, being a family company for the most part, aside from one man, being a family company. That's kind of just what they knew and what they were good at. And I think it was in this speech when Pete Docter won for best animated film. I think it was in this speech where he was just talking about like, you know, this was like, I wanted to make a movie that I would sit down and watch and my kids would sit down and watch. And what would they watch? And this, they want a talking dog. They want a bird that doesn't exist. They want adventure and they want, you know, heroes and villains. That's what they want. And this movie just nails all of it in such a short amount of time.
Yet your protagonist is a 70-year-old man. And it's not a goofball 70-year-old man like a lot of children's characters are. It is a very real human going through some real stuff.
Yeah, I like the fact that what sets him onto the adventure isn't something made up. It's that they're going to tear down his house that he built his whole life on that small little street. And now it's a city and he built his whole life there. and he hits the guy in the face because he's touching the mailbox or the mailbox is broken. Yeah. And he's not a villain, but they play him up like he's a villain. And then he gets sued and now he's got to get kicked out and blah, blah, blah. I love how realistic all of that is. It's more heartbreaking that way. It's more meaningful that way. And it's more exciting when he eventually comes back and is able to let go of the past at least a little bit and start to move on and move forward with the rest of his life. I just think there's so many great themes in this movie that even the best Pixar movies sometimes don't have. You know, sometimes the best Pixar movies only have one or two themes. This one's just loaded with them. And yeah, you're right. You think about Sword in the Stone with Merlin or something like that. Or even the horrific Black Cauldron, where you have whatever Fluterflam or whatever his stupid name is. You look at these movies, and it always is a crazy character. It's always a zany guy. It's never a normal guy. He's just a normal guy who, when he meets his childhood hero, the child comes back out of him. Mm-hmm. The same way the child would come out of our grandparents if they got to meet somebody that they never thought they would meet. You know what I mean? Like, there's just that. There's that sense of you never really lose that. You just kind of lose sight of where it is. If you see Rey and the Last Dragon before the movie, they have the short with the two old people dancing in the rain. And like essentially when the rain's there, it's a very similar theme to what you see in Up, done in a short with no dialogue. And it was clearly meant to come before Soul, not Rey and the Last Dragon. It sure feels out of place before Rey and the Last Dragon, but it's a very similar theme. Of you don't lose it, you just kind of forget where it is and you get stuck in your ways. And you know, Up does a good job of acknowledging that while also making Russell a really fun character and having the relationship between them feel like a real relationship. It doesn't just instantly, okay, now we're friends or now we're enemies. It feels authentic as it goes through the entire time.
Yeah, and part of that comes from the fact that I think the scene that really does it with Carl and Russell's relationship is the one where Carl's thinking he should put Russell down on one of the buildings.
Yes, it's so funny. Oh my god,
because that sets it there, and it's just like, no, that won't work. And like, that's the moment where Carl realizes, okay, he's responsible for this kid now.
Yep.
And he remains reluctant for so long, but eventually, like, we do get that he kind of has that missing aspect that was. He lost with Ellie dying, mm-hmm. and then Russell gets his missing aspect of like having a father figure.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I love the scene at the end of them counting the cars after, you know, we hear about with the father, blue, red, and then Doug goes gray because.
Oh, yes. So great
joke. Unbelievably such a quick one liner. You'd miss it. If you just coughed, you wouldn't even know it was there. Such a phenomenal line. Up. Second animated movie ever nominated for Best Picture behind just Beauty and the Beast. And then it kind of set the motion for this started to become a little bit more normal. This was the year we had talked about with The Dark Knight earlier and with Tropic Thunder and with The Wrestler. Yeah, The Wrestler. Those movies all came out in 2008. We just happened to have a big run on them early on. If you checked out those episodes, make sure to check them out. But this was the year that it was the first time it went to 10. So Up was nominated. The next year, Toy Story 3 was nominated and just kept kind of going. In my opinion, Up could have won this Oscar. Up maybe should have won this Oscar. And I think that had this been in 2010 and the movies were just simply reversed, where Toy Story 3 came out in 2009 against every movie it was up against in 2010, King's Speech still wins, but Up comes out the next year. I think there's a good chance Up does win Best Picture because I think people would have just been so blown away and they would have been okay with a movie that was animated winning because they would have been used to it at least being nominated. Because they would have seen it. But being only the second one and the first one in 18 years, it's a long time in between nominations. And it just didn't bode well, unfortunately, for Up, which this was one of the weaker years, I do believe, in terms of the 2000s with you know, nominees, at least. So, yeah.
Well, we've talked about a lot of strong movies in this year instead that weren't nominated for anything.
Well, yes. We're talking about A Single Man at some point. What one do you have in mind from 2009? What one is the one you have in mind from 2009? I don't know if I cut out there or you, but what's the other one that you have?
I can't remember at this point. I have to look.
It's all good. Don't worry. Don't worry. I just remember A Single Man wasn't nominated and that just blew my mind, but we'll get into it. We'll get there. Yeah. This was Jason Reitman before Jason Reitman just became bad at directing. But so anyway, that covers tonight. Do you have anything else you want to say about Up or should we kind of tease into next week?
No, just adventure is out there, and that's it.
Yeah, exactly. Adventure is out there. There you go. We actually have a double-sided Carl and Ellie puzzle, 1,000-piece puzzle. One side it's them young, the other side it's them old. It's like the coolest puzzle in the world. But anyway, next week we are going full-blown popular. Just kidding. We have half popular and half you guys probably never seen the movie because that's what we do here. John's number 89 is Fight Club, a movie you all may have heard of and probably don't understand. No, I'm just kidding. But that is the whole rumor that goes around the internet is that if you watch Fight Club, you don't understand what it was about, which I think gives it's men a little too little credit.
It's going to be really hard to talk about that movie next week, too.
Yes. Yes. We're not supposed to.
We're not supposed to.
Maybe we just won't. But Fight Club next week. And then my number 89 is Cabaret, the movie that lost to The Godfather, but Bob Fosse won Best Director over Francis Ford Coppola that year, which, as history has moved on, would probably be very mind-blowing to some people. So I'm excited to talk about Cabaret. It's a musical, but all of the music is set in realistic settings. So there's no just breaking down into song and dance like in Wizard of Oz. It is very much they work at the cabaret and they sing at the cabaret. John, have you seen Cabaret or no?
I've seen stage productions. I've never actually seen the original film.
Okay. Though. I am interested to see what you will think of the movie because I have not seen a stage production because I don't see stage productions, but I have seen the movie numerous times and it is another one that every time it gets better and better. And boy, does it have some powerful, powerful, powerful moments. Because at the end of the day, well, for anybody who doesn't know, it is a movie about Nazi Germany and a cabaret that is taking place as the Nazi party is starting to take over. And that, again, impending doom feeling, they don't know what they're about to live through, but they know it's coming. Such a good movie. Looking forward to talking about that one. And of course, looking forward to talking about Fight Club, a movie that really did. It's just, I mean, it's iconic. It's not on my top 100, but it is iconic for so many reasons. So anyway, I'm about to go live with Alexa talking about our 9th episode of the Classic Survivor Series, Tastes Like Chicken, all about Russell Hantz blindsiding somebody with an idol. So make sure to tune into that. It'll be live in 5 minutes. John, thank you again, as always, for being on. People, follow us on Letterboxd, PWood43 and Jay Millsip. I haven't watched as many movies of late, but I have been seeing some. I got about halfway through one today and then had a severe issue happen here at the old apartment complex. So you got to love when stuff like that happens. But all of that, I've been trying to keep up with it. I did have a chance to see Minari. If you've not seen Minari, great little movie. You definitely got to check that one out. And I'm very happy to see Grandma, who is not a grandma, won the SAG award. And I hope that leads to her winning the Oscar because it is not even freaking close, people. She is unbelievable in that movie. And if you don't know her name, get to know it because she is unreal in that movie. Anyway, go check that one out. John, thanks as always. I'll see you next time. Fight Club and Cabaret. That's one you got to tune into. You have to tune into that. There's no way you can't. See everybody in 5 minutes.